You haven't come yet. It's just unmoving inside me, as if it's thinking about something, am I right? I nod. Take it out, she admonishes me. And let's pretend this never happened. I can forget it, and so should you. I'm your sister, and you're my brother. Even if we're not blood related, we're most definitely brother and sister. You understand what I'm saying? We're part of a family. We shouldn't be doing this. It's too late, I tell her. Why? Because I decided it is. Because you decided it is, says the boy named Crow. You don't want to be at the mercy of things outside you anymore, or thrown into confusion by things you can't control. You've already murdered your father, and violated your mother, and now, here you are inside your sister. If there's a curse in all this, you mean to grab it by the horns and fulfill the program that's been laid out for you. Lift the burden from your shoulders and live. Not caught up in someone else's schemes, but as you. That's what you want. She covers her face with her hands and cries a little. You feel sorry for her, but there's no way you're going to leave her body. Your cock swells up inside her, gets even harder, as though it's set down roots. I understand, she says. I won't say any more. But I want you to remember something. You're raping me. I like you, but this isn't how I want it to be. We might never see each other again, no matter how much we want to meet later on. Are you okay with that? You don't respond. Your mind's switched off. You draw her close to you and start to move your hips. Carefully. Cautiously, in the end, violently. You try to remember the shapes of the trees to help you get back, but they all look the same, and are soon swallowed up in the anonymous sea. Sakura closes her eyes and gives herself up to the motion. She doesn't say a word or resist. Her face is expressionless, turned away from you. But you feel the pleasure rising up in her. Like an extension of yourself. Now you understand it. The entwined trees stand like a dark wall blocking your view. The bird no longer sends its message. And you come. I come. And I wake up. I'm in bed, alone. It's the middle of the night. The darkness is as deep as it can be, all clocks lost within. I get out of bed, strip off my underpants, go over to the kitchen and rinse the semen off them. Gooey, white and heavy, like some illegitimate child born of the darkness. I gulp down glass after glass of water, but nothing slakes my thirst. I feel so alone, I can't stand it. In the darkness, in the middle of the night, surrounded by a deep forest, I couldn't be more alone. There are no seasons here, no light. I walk back to the bed, sit down, and breathe a huge sigh. The darkness wraps itself around me. The thing inside you has revealed itself. The shell is gone, shattered, nowhere to be seen. And it's there, a dark shadow resting. Your hands are sticky with something. Human blood, by the look of it. You hold them out in front of you, but there's not enough light to see. It's far too dark. Both inside and out.
40. Next to the sign that read Komura Memorial Library was a placard informing them that the library's hours were 11 to 5, except for Monday, when it was closed, that admission was free, and tours were conducted every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Hoshino read all this aloud for Nakata. Today's Monday, so it's closed, Hoshino said. He glanced at his watch. Not that it matters much, since it's way past their closing time anyway. Same difference.
Mr. Hoshino?
Yeah.
This place doesn't look at all like the library we went to before, Nakata said.
That was a large public library, and this one's private, so the scale's different.
When you say a private library, what does that mean?
It means some man of property who likes books puts up a building and makes all the books he's collected available to the public. This guy must have really been something. You can tell from the gate that he had to be pretty impressive.
What is a man of property?
A rich person.
What's the difference between the two?
Hoshino tilted his head in thought. I don't know. Seems to me a man of property is more cultured than just a regular rich guy.
Cultured?
Anybody who has money is rich. You and me, as long as we had money, we'd be rich. But becoming a man of property isn't so easy. It takes time.
It's difficult to become one.
Yeah, it is. Not that we need to worry about it. I don't see either of us becoming rich, let alone cultured.
Mr. Hoshino?
Yeah.
Since they're closed on Monday, if we come here tomorrow morning at 11, they should be open, right?
Nakata asked. I suppose so. Tomorrow's Tuesday.
Will Nakata be able to go inside the library?
The sign says it's open to everybody. Of course you can.
Even if I can't read?
No problem, Hoshino said. They don't quiz people at the entrance about whether they can read or not.
I want to go inside, then.
We'll come back tomorrow, first thing, and go in together, Hoshino said.
I've got a question for you first, though. This is the place you were looking for, right? And the thing you are looking for is inside.
Nakata removed his cap and vigorously rubbed his close-cropped hair.
Yes, I think it's here.
So we can give up our search?
That's right. The search is over.
Thank God, Hoshino said. I was starting to wonder if we'd really be driving around till autumn. The two of them drove back to Colonel Sanders' apartment, slept soundly, and set off at 11 the next morning for the library. It was only a 20-minute walk from the apartment, so they decided to stroll over. Hoshino had already returned the rental car. The gate of the library was open wide when they arrived. It looked as if it was going to be a hot, humid day, and someone had splashed water on the pavement to keep the dust down. Past the gate was a neat, well-kept garden.
Mr. Nakata? Hoshino said in front of the gate. Yes, how can I help you?
What do we do after we go inside the library? I'm always afraid you're all of a sudden going to come up with some off-the-wall idea, so I'd like to know about it ahead of time. I have to prepare myself. Nakata gave it some thought.
Nakata has no idea what to do once we get in. This is a library, though, so I thought we might start by reading books. I'll find a photo collection or book of paintings, and you can pick whatever you'd like to read.
Gotcha. Start by reading. That makes sense.
Then after a while we can think about what to do next.
Okay, Hoshino said. We'll think about what comes later. Later. Sounds like a plan. They walked through the beautiful garden and into the antique-looking entrance. There was a reception area just inside, with a handsome, slim young man seated behind the counter. He had on a white button-down shirt and small glasses. Long, fine hair hung over his forehead. Someone you might expect to see in a black-and-white Truffaut film, Hoshino thought. The young man looked up at them and beamed. Good morning, Hoshino said cheerfully.
Good morning, the young man replied. Welcome to the library.
We'd, like to read some books.
Of course, Oshima nodded. Feel free to read whatever you like. We're open to the public. The stacks are completely open, so take any books you'd like to read. You can look books up in our card catalogue or online, and if you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask. I'd be more than happy to help.
That's very kind of you.
Is there a particular field or book you're looking for?
Hoshino shook his head.
Not really. Actually, we're more interested in the library itself than books. We happened to pass by and thought the place looked interesting. It's a beautiful building.
Oshima gave a graceful smile and picked up a neatly sharpened pencil.
A lot of people just stop by like that. Glad to hear it, Hoshino said. If you have the time, you might consider the short tour of the place that takes place at 2. We have one every Tuesday, as long as there are people who'd like to join in. The head of the library explains the background of the institution, and today just happens to be Tuesday.
That sounds like fun. Hey, what you say, Mr. Nakata?
All the time Hoshino and Oshima had been talking at the counter, Nakata stood off to one side, cap in hand, gazing vacantly at his surroundings. At the sound of his name, he came out of his daze.
Yes? How can I help you?
They have a tour of the library at 2. You want to go on it?
Yes, Mr. Hoshino, thank you. Nakata would like to.
Oshima watched this exchange with great interest. Messrs. Hoshino and Nakata, what sort of relationship did they have to each other? They didn't seem like relatives. A strange pair, these two, with a vast difference in age and appearance. What could they possibly have in common? And this Mr. Nakata, the older one, had an odd way of speaking. There was something about him Oshima couldn't quite pin down. Not anything bad, though.
Have you travelled far to get here? He asked.
We came from Nagoya, Hoshino said hurriedly before Nakata could open his mouth.
If he started in about being from Nakano, things could get a little sticky. The TV news had already put out the word that an old man like Nakata was connected with the murder there. Fortunately, though, as far as Hoshino knew, Nakata's photograph hadn't been made public.
That's quite a journey, Oshima observed. Yes, we crossed a bridge to get here, Nakata said. A long, wonderful bridge.
It is pretty long, isn't it? Oshima said, though I've never been over it myself.
Nakata had never seen such a long bridge in all his life.
It took a lot of time and a tremendous amount of money to build it, Oshima went on. According to the newspaper, each year the public corporation that operates the bridge and the highway over it is 100 billion yen in the red. Our taxes make up the shortfall.
Nakata has no idea how much 100 billion is.
I don't either, to be honest, Oshima said. After a certain point, amounts like that aren't real anymore. Anyway, it's a huge amount of money.
Thanks so much, Hoshino butted in.
There was no telling what Nakata might say next, and he had to nip that possibility in the bud.
We should be here at 2 for the tour, right?
Yes, 2 would be fine, Oshima said. The head librarian will be happy to show you around then.
We'll be reading until then, Hoshino said.
Twirling his pencil in his hand, Oshima watched the retreating figures and then went back to work. They picked some books from the stacks, Oshino going for Beethoven and his generation. Nakata picked out some photo collections and placed them on the table. Next, much as a dog might, he circled the room, studying everything, touching things, sniffing their odour, stopping at select spots to stare fixedly. They had the reading room to themselves until past 12, so no one else noticed the old man's eccentric behaviour.
"Hey, Gramps," Hoshino whispered.
"Yes? How may I help you?"
"This is kind of sudden, but I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't mention to anyone that you're from Nakano."
"Why is that?"
"It's a long story, just take my word for it. If people find out that's where you're from, it might cause some trouble."
"I understand,"
Nakata said, nodding deeply.
"It's not good to trouble others. Nakata won't say a word about being from Nakano."
"That'd be great," Hoshino said.
"Oh, did you find whatever it is you're looking for?" "No, nothing so far. But this is definitely the place."
Nakata nodded.
"It is. Last night I had a good talk with the stone before I went to bed. I'm sure this is the place.
Thank God."
Hoshino nodded and returned to his biography. Beethoven, he learned, was a proud man who believed absolutely in his own abilities and never bothered to flatter the nobility. Believing that art itself and the proper expression of emotions was the most sublime thing in the world, he thought political power and wealth served only one purpose— to make art possible. When Haydn boarded with a noble family, as he did most of his professional life, he had to eat with the servants. Musicians of Haydn's generation were considered employees. The unaffected and good-natured Haydn, though, much preferred this arrangement to the stiff and formal meals put on by the nobility. Beethoven, in contrast, was enraged by any such contemptuous treatment, on occasion smashing things against the wall in anger. He insisted that as far as meals went, he should be treated with no less respect than the nobility he ostensibly served. He often flew off the handle, and once angry was hard to calm down. On top of this were radical political ideas that he made no attempt to hide. As his hearing deteriorated, these tendencies became even more pronounced. As he aged, his music also became both more expansive and more densely inward-looking. Only Beethoven could have balanced these two contrasting tendencies. But the extraordinary effort this required had a progressively deleterious effect on his life, for all humans have physical and emotional limits, and by this time the composer had more than reached his. "Geniuses like that don't have it easy," Hoshino thought, impressed, and laid down his book. He remembered the bronze bust of a scowling Beethoven in the music room of his school, but until now he'd had no idea of the hardships the man had endured. No wonder the guy looked so sour. "I'm never going to be a genius, that's for sure," Hoshino thought. He looked over at Nakata, who was deep into a collection of photographs of traditional folk furniture, and working an imaginary chisel and plane. Those photos must have made him unconsciously feel like he was back at his old job. And Nakata? Who knows? He might become a great person some day, Hoshino thought. Most people can't do the kind of things he does. The old codger's definitely in a class of his own. After 12, two other readers, middle-aged women, came into the reading room, so Hoshino and Nakata took the opportunity to take a breather outside. Hoshino had brought along some bread for their lunch, while Nakata was lugging around his usual thermos of hot tea. Hoshino first asked Oshima at the counter whether it was all right to eat in the library grounds. "Of course," Oshima replied. "It's nice to sit on the veranda overlooking the garden. Afterwards, feel free to come in for a cup of coffee. I've already made some, so help yourself." "Thanks," Hoshino said. "This is quite a cozy place you have here." Oshima smiled and brushed back his hair. "It is a little different from your normal library. Cozy is a good way to describe it. What we're trying to create is an intimate space where people can relax and enjoy reading." Oshino found Oshima an appealing young man. Intelligent, well-groomed, obviously from a good family, and quite kind. He's got to be gay, right? Not that Hoshino cared. To each his own, was his thinking. Some men talk with stones, and some sleep with other men. After lunch, Hoshino stood up, stretched his whole body, then went back to reception to take Oshima up on his offer of a cup of coffee. Since Nakata didn't drink coffee, he stayed on the veranda, sipping his tea and gazing at the birds flitting about the garden. "So, did you find anything interesting to read?" Oshima asked Hoshino.
"Yeah, I've been reading a biography of Beethoven," Hoshino replied. "I like it. His life really gives you plenty to think about."
Oshima nodded. "He went through a lot, to put it mildly."
"He did have a tough time," Hoshino said. "But I think it was mainly his fault. I mean, he was so self-centered and uncooperative. All he thought about was himself and his music, and he didn't mind sacrificing whatever he had to for it. He must have been tough to get along with. Hey, Ludwig, give me a break. That's what I would have said if I knew him. No wonder his nephew went off his rocker. But I have to admit, his music is wonderful. It really gets to you. It's a strange thing."
"Absolutely," Oshima agreed. "But why did he have to live such a hard, wild life? He would have been better off with a more normal type of life."
Oshima twirled a pencil around in his fingers.
"I see your point. But by Beethoven's time, people thought it was important to express the ego. Earlier, when there was an absolute monarchy, this would have been considered improper, socially deviant behavior, and suppressed quite severely. Once the bourgeoisie came to power in the 19th century, however, that suppression came to an end, and the individual ego was liberated to express itself. Freedom and the emancipation of the ego were synonymous. And art, music in particular, was at the forefront of all this. Those who came after Beethoven and lived under his shadow, so to speak, Berlioz, Wagner, Liszt, Schumann, all lived eccentric, stormy lives. Eccentricity was seen as almost the ideal lifestyle. The age of Romanticism, they called it.
though I'm sure living like that was pretty hard on them at times. So, you like Beethoven's music?
I can't really say if I do or not. I haven't heard that much, Hoshino admitted. Hardly any at all, actually. I just kind of like that piece called The Archduke Trio.
That is nice, yes.
The Million Dollar Trio's great, Hoshino added.
I prefer the Czech group, the Suk Trio, myself, Oshima said. They have a beautiful balance. You feel as if you can smell the wind wafting over a green meadow. But I do know the Million Dollar Trio version, Rubinstein, Heifetz and Feuermann. It's an elegant performance.
Mr. Oshima, Hoshino asked, looking at the nameplate on the counter. You know a lot about music, I can tell.
Oshima smiled. Not a lot. I just enjoy listening to it.
Do you think music has the power to change people? As though you listen to a piece and go through some major change inside?
Oshima nodded. Sure, that can happen. We have an experience, like a chemical reaction, that transforms something inside us. When we examine ourselves later on, we discover that all the standards we've lived by have shot up another notch, and the world's opened up in unexpected ways. Yes, I've had that experience. Not often, but it has happened. It's like falling in love.
Hoshino had never fallen head over heels in love himself, but went ahead and nodded anyway.
That's got to be a very important thing, right? He said. For our lives.
It is, Oshima answered. Without those peak experiences, our lives would be pretty dull and flat. Berlioz put it this way, a life without once reading Hamlet is like a life spent in a coal mine.
A coal mine?
Just typical 19th century hyperbole.
Well, thanks for the coffee, Oshima said. I'm happy we could talk.
Oshima gave him a big grin in reply. Hoshino and Nakata read books until 2, Nakata going through his carpenter's motions as he leafed through the furniture photographs. Apart from the middle-aged ladies, 3 other readers had joined them after lunch, but only Hoshino and Nakata asked to go on the tour of the library.
"You don't mind it's just the 2 of us?" Hoshino asked. "I feel bad that you have to go to all this trouble just for us."
"No trouble at all," Oshima said. "The head librarian is happy to conduct the tour, even for 1 person."
At 2 on the dot, a good-looking middle-aged woman came down the stairs. Back held straight, she had an impressive walk. She wore a dark blue suit with severe lines, black high heels, a thin silver necklace at her wide open neckline, her hair gathered at the back. Nothing extraneous, altogether a highly refined, tasteful look.
"Hello, my name's Saeki. I'm the head librarian," the woman said, and smiled calmly.
"I'm Hoshino."
"I'm Nakata, and I'm from Nakano," the old man said, hat in hand. "We're glad you've come to visit us from so far away," Miss Saeki said.
A chill ran down Hoshino's spine at Nakata's words, but Miss Saeki didn't look suspicious. Nakata was characteristically oblivious.
"Yes, I crossed a very big bridge," he said.
"This is a wonderful building,"
Hoshino interjected, trying to cut off any talk of bridges.
"The building was built in the early Meiji period as the library and guest house of the Komura family," Miss Saeki began. "Many literati visited and lodged here. It's been designated a historical site by the city."
"Literati?"
Nakata asked. Miss Saeki smiled. "Artists, poets, novelists, and so forth. In the past, men of property in various localities helped support artists. Art was different then, and wasn't viewed as something one should make a living at. The Komuras were men of property in this region who sponsored culture and the arts. This library was built and is operated to pass that legacy to future generations."
"Man of property, Nakata knows what that means," Nakata said. "It takes a long time to become one."
Smiling, Miss Saeki nodded.
"You're quite right, it does. No matter how much money you accumulate, you can't buy time."
"Well, we'll begin our tour on the first floor."
They visited the rooms upstairs one by one. Miss Saeki gave her usual talk about the various literati who had stayed there, and showed the 2 men the calligraphy and paintings those artists had left behind. During the tour, Nakata seemed to turn a deaf ear to what she was saying, instead curiously examining each and every item. In the study Miss Saeki used as her office, A fountain pen was sitting on the desk. It was up to Hoshino to follow her and make all the appropriate noises. All the while he was in a state of anxiety, worried that the old man would suddenly do something bizarre. But all Nakata did was continue to scrutinize the items they passed by. Miss Saeki didn't seem to mind what Nakata did. Smiling all the while, she briskly showed them around. Hoshino was impressed by how calm and collected she was. The tour ended in 20 minutes, and the two men thanked their guide. Miss Saeki's smile never failed her the entire time. The more Hoshino watched her, though, the more confused he grew. "She smiles and looks at us," he told himself, "but she doesn't see anything. She's looking at us, but she's seeing something else." But all the time she was giving the tour, even if her mind was elsewhere, she was perfectly polite and kind. Whenever he asked a question, she gave a kind, easy-to-follow answer. It's not as if she's doing this against her will or anything. A part of her enjoys doing a meticulous job, but her heart isn't in it. The two men returned to the reading room and settled down on the sofa with their books. As he turned the pages, though, Hoshino couldn't get Miss Saeki out of his mind. There was something very unusual about that beautiful woman, but he couldn't put his finger on it. He gave up and went back to reading. At 3 o'clock, totally without warning, Nakata stood up. His movements were uncharacteristically decisive. He held his hat firmly in his hand.
"Hey, what's up? Where are you going?"
Hoshino whispered. But there was no response. Lips set in a determined look, Nakata was already hurrying towards the main entrance, his belongings left behind on the floor. Hoshino shut his book and stood up. Something was definitely wrong.
"Hey, hang on!"
he called. Realizing the old man wasn't about to, he scrambled after him. The other readers looked up and watched him leave. Before he reached the entrance, Nakata turned left and without hesitating started up to the first floor. No visitors allowed beyond this point sign at the foot of the stairs didn't deter him, since he couldn't read. His worn tennis shoes squeaked on the floorboards as he climbed the stairs.
"Excuse me,"
Oshima said, leaning over the counter to call out to the retreating figure. "That area is closed now." Nakata didn't seem to hear him. Hoshino ran up the stairs after him.
"Gramps, it's closed. You can't go there."
Oshima came out from behind the counter and followed them up the stairs. Undaunted, Nakata strode down the corridor and into the study. The door was open. Miss Saeki, her back to the window, was sitting at the desk reading a book. She heard the footsteps and looked up. When he got to the desk, Nakata stood there looking down at her face. Neither of them said a word. A moment later, Hoshino arrived, shortly followed by Oshima.
"There you are," Hoshino said, tapping the old man on the shoulder. "You're not supposed to be here. It's off limits. We have to leave, okay?"
"Nakata has something to say," he said to Miss Saeki.
"And what would that be?" Miss Saeki asked quietly.
"I want to talk about the stone, the entrance stone."
For a while, Miss Saeki silently studied the old man's face. Her eyes shone with a non-committal light. She blinked a few times, then closed her book. She rested both hands on the desk and looked up again at Nakata. She looked undecided as to how to proceed, but then gave a small nod. She looked over at Hoshino, then at Oshima.
"Would you mind leaving us alone for a while?" she said to Oshima. "We're going to have a talk. Please close the door on your way out."
Oshima hesitated, then nodded. He gently took Hoshino's arm, led him out to the corridor, and shut the door.
"Are you sure it's okay?" Hoshino asked.
"Miss Saeki knows what she's doing,"
Oshima said as he escorted him back down the stairs.
"If she says it's all right, it's all right. No need to worry about her. So, Mr. Hoshino, why don't we go and have a cup of coffee while we're waiting?"
"Well, when it comes to Mr. Nakata, worrying's a total waste of time," Hoshino said, shaking his head. "That much I can guarantee."
41. When I go into the woods this time, I've kitted myself out with everything I might need. Compass, knife, canteen, some emergency food, work gloves, a can of yellow spray paint, and the small hatchet I'd used before. I stuff all this into a small nylon rucksack that was also in the tool shed, and head into the forest. I'm wearing a long-sleeved shirt, a towel wrapped around my neck, and the cap Oshima gave me, and I've sprayed insect repellent over all the exposed parts of my body. The sky's overcast, and it's hot and sticky, as if it might rain any minute. So I throw a poncho into the rucksack, just in case. A flock of birds screech at each other as they cut across the low, leaden sky. I easily reach that round clearing in the forest. Checking my compass to be sure I'm generally heading north, I go deeper into the woods. This time I spray yellow markings on tree trunks to mark the route. Unlike Hansel and Gretel's breadcrumbs, spray paint's safe from hungry birds. I'm better prepared, so I'm not as afraid. I'm nervous, sure, but my heart's not pounding. Curiosity's what's leading me on. I want to know what lies down this path. Even if there's nothing there, I want to know that. I have to know. Memorizing the scenery as I pass by, I move steadily forward, step by careful step. Occasionally there's some weird sound, a thud like something hitting the ground, a creak like floorboards groaning under weight, and others I can't even describe. I have no idea what these mean, since there's no knowing what they are. Sometimes they sound far away, sometimes very close by. The sense of distance expanding and contracting. Birds' wings echo above me, sounding louder, more exaggerated than they should. Every time I hear this, I stop and listen, holding my breath, waiting for something to happen. Nothing does, and I walk on. Besides these sudden, unexpected sounds, everything else is still. There's no wind, no rustle of leaves in the treetops, only my own footsteps as I push through the undergrowth. When I step on a fallen branch, the snap reverberates through the air. I grasp the hatchet, which I'd sharpened, and it feels rough in my gloveless hands. Up to this point it hasn't come in handy, but its heft is comforting and makes me feel protected. But from what? There aren't any bears or wolves in this forest. A few poisonous snakes, perhaps. The most dangerous creature here would have to be me. So maybe I'm just frightened of my own shadow. Even so, as I walk, I get the feeling that something, somewhere, is watching me, listening to me, holding its breath, blending into the background, watching my every move. Somewhere far off, something's listening to all the sounds I make, trying to guess where I'm going and why. I try not to think about it. The more you think about illusions, the more they'll swell up and take on form, and no longer be an illusion. I try whistling to fill in the silence. The soprano sax from Coltrane's My Favorite Things. Though of course my dubious whistling doesn't come anywhere near the complex, lightning-quick original. I just add bits so that what I hear in my head approximates the sound. Better than nothing, I reckon. I glance at my watch. It's 10:30. Oshima must be getting the library ready to open. Today would be Wednesday. I picture him sprinkling water in the garden, wiping off the desks with a cloth, boiling water and brewing some coffee. All the tasks I normally take care of. But now I'm here, deep in the forest, heading deeper. Nobody has any idea I'm here. The only ones who do are me. And them. I go on down the path. Calling it a path, though, isn't quite right. It's more like some natural kind of channel that water's carved out over time. When there's a downpour in the forest, rushing water gouges out the dirt, sweeping the grasses before it, exposing the roots of trees. When it hits a boulder, it makes a detour. Once the rain lets up, you're left with a dry riverbed that's something like a path. This pseudo-path is covered with ferns and green grass, and if you don't pay attention, you'll lose it entirely. It gets steep every once in a while, and I scramble up by grabbing hold of tree trunks. Somewhere along the line, Coltrane's soprano sax runs out of steam. Now it's McCoy Tyner's piano solo I hear, the left hand carving out a repetitious rhythm, and the right layering on thick, forbidding chords. Like some mythic scene, the music portrays somebody's, a nameless, faceless somebody's, dim past, all the details laid out as clearly as entrails being dragged out of the darkness. Or at least, that's how it sounds to me. The patient, repeating music, ever so slowly breaks apart the reel, rearranging the pieces. It has a hypnotic, menacing smell, just like the forest. I hike along, spraying marks on the trees as I go, sometimes turning to make sure these yellow marks are still visible. It's okay. The marks that will lead me home are like an uneven line of buoys in the sea. Just to be doubly sure, every once in a while, I hack out a notch in a tree trunk. My little hatchet isn't very sharp, so I pick out the thinner, softer-looking trunks to hack. The trees receive these blows in silence. Huge black mosquitoes buzz me like reconnaissance patrols, aiming for the exposed skin around my eyes. When I hear their buzz, I brush them away or squash them. Whenever I crush one, it makes a squish, already bloated with blood it sucked out of me. It feels itchy only later. I wipe the blood off my hands on the towel around my neck. The army, marching through these woods, if it was summer, must have had the same problems with mosquitoes. Full battle gear. How much would that have weighed? Those old-style rifles, like a clump of iron. Ammunition belt, bayonet, steel helmet, a couple of grenades, food and rations, of course, tools to dig foxholes, mess kit. All that gear must add up to well over 40 pounds. Damn heavy, and a lot more than my little rucksack. I have the distinct feeling that I'm going to bump into those soldiers round the next bend, but they disappeared here more than 60 years ago. I remember reading about Napoleon's troops marching into Russia in the summer of 1812. They must have swatted away their share of mosquitoes too on that long road to Moscow. Of course, mosquitoes weren't the only problem. They had to struggle to survive all kinds of other things. Hunger, thirst, muddy roads, infectious disease, sweltering heat, Cossack commandos attacking their thin supply lines, lack of medical supplies, not to mention huge battles with the regular Russian army. When the French forces finally straggled into a deserted Moscow, their number had been reduced from 500,000 to a mere 100,000. I stop and take a swig of water from my canteen. My watch shows exactly 11 o'clock. The library is opening up. Oshima's unlocking the door, taking his usual seat behind the counter, a stack of long, neatly sharpened pencils on the desk. He picks one up and twirls it, gently pushing the rubber end against his temple. I can see it all clearly, but that place is so far away. "I've never had a period," says Oshima. "I do anal sex and have never used my vagina for sex. My clitoris is sensitive, but my breasts aren't." I remember Oshima asleep in the bed in the cabin, his face to the wall, and the signs he, she, left behind. Cloaked in those signs, I went to sleep in the same bed. I give up thinking about it anymore. Instead, I think about war. The Napoleonic Wars. The war the Japanese soldiers had to go off and fight. I feel the heft of the hatchet in my hands. That pale, sharp blade glints, and I have to turn my eyes away from it. Why do people wage war? Why do hundreds of thousands, even millions of people, group together and try to annihilate each other? Do people start wars out of anger? Or fear? Or are anger and fear just two aspects of the same spirit? I hack another notch in a tree. The tree cries out silently, bleeding invisible blood. I keep trudging on. Coltrane picks up his soprano sax again, Once more, the repetition breaks apart the reel, rearranging the pieces. Before long, my mind wanders into the realm of dreams. They come back so quietly. I'm holding Sakura. She's in my arms, and I'm inside her. I don't want to be at the mercy of things outside me anymore, thrown into confusion by things I can't control. I've already murdered my father and violated my mother. And now, here I am inside my sister. If there's a curse in all this, I mean to grab it by the horns and fulfill the program that's been laid out for me. Lift the burden from my shoulders and live. Not caught up in someone else's schemes, but as me. That's what I really want. And I come inside her. Even if it's in a dream, you shouldn't have done that, the boy named Crow calls out. He's right behind me, walking in the forest. I tried my best to stop you. I wanted you to understand. You heard, but you didn't listen. You just forged ahead. I don't respond or turn round, just silently keep on trudging. You thought that's how you could overcome the curse, right? But was it? Crow asks. But was it? You killed the person who's your father, violated your mother, and now your sister. You thought that would put an end to the curse your father laid on you, so you did everything that was prophesied about you. But nothing's really over. You didn't overcome anything. That curse is branded on your soul even deeper than before. You should realize that by now. That curse is part of your DNA. You breathe out the curse. The wind carries it to the four corners of the earth. But the dark confusion inside you remains. Your fear, anger, unease. Nothing's disappeared. They're all still inside you. Still torturing you. Listen, there's no war that will end all wars, Crow tells me. War grows within war, lapping up the blood shed by violence, feeding on wounded flesh. War is a perfect, self-contained being. You need to know that. Sakura, my sister, I say. I shouldn't have raped her. Even if it was in a dream. What should I do? I ask, staring at the ground in front of me. You have to overcome the fear and anger inside you, the boy named Crow says. Let a bright light shine in and melt the coldness in your heart. That's what being tough is all about. Do that, and you really will be the toughest 15-year-old on the planet. You following me? There's still time. You can still get yourself back. Use your head. Think about what you've got to do. You're no dunce. You should be able to work it out. Did I really murder my father? I ask. No reply. I swing round, but the boy named Crow is gone, and the silence swallows my question. Alone in such a dense forest, the person called me feels empty, horribly empty. Ushima once used the term hollow men. Well, that's what I've become. There's a void inside me, a blank that's slowly expanding, devouring what's left of who I am. I can hear it happening. I'm totally lost, my identity dying. There's no direction where I am, no sky, no ground. I think of Miss Saiki, of Sakura, of Ushima. But I'm light years away from them. It's as though I'm looking through the wrong end of a pair of binoculars, and no matter how far I stretch out my hand, I can't touch them. I'm all alone, in the middle of a dim maze. Listen to the wind, Ushima told me. I listen, but no wind's blowing. Even the boy named Crow has vanished. Use your head. Think about what you've got to do. But I can't think anymore. No matter how much I use my head, I finish up at a dead end in the maze. What is it inside me that makes up me? Is this what's supposed to stand up to the void? If only I could wipe out this me who's here, right here and right now. I seriously consider it. In this thick wall of trees, on this path that's not a path, if I stopped breathing, my consciousness would silently be buried in the darkness. Every last drop of my dark, violent blood dripping out, my DNA rotting among the weeds. Then my battle would be over. Otherwise, I'll be eternally murdering my father, violating my mother, violating my sister, lashing out at the world forever. I close my eyes and try to find my center. The darkness that covers it is rough and jagged. There's a break in the dark clouds. It's like looking out of the window to see the leaves of the dogwood gleaming like a thousand blades in the moonlight. I feel something rearranging itself under my skin, and there's a tinkling sound in my head. I open my eyes and take a deep breath. I throw away the can of spray paint, the hatchet, the compass. From far away, I hear them all clatter to the ground. I feel lighter. I slip the rucksack off my shoulders and toss it aside. My sense of touch seems suddenly acute. The air around me has grown more transparent. My sense of the forest has grown more intense. Coltrane's labyrinthine solo plays on in my ears, never ending. Thinking it over, I reach into the rucksack and take out the hunting knife and stuff it in my trouser pocket. The razor-sharp knife I stole from my father's desk. If need be, I could use it to slash my wrists and let every last drop of blood inside me gush out onto the ground. That would destroy the device. I head into the heart of the forest, a hollow man, a void that devours all that's substantial. So there is nothing left to fear, not a thing. And I head into the heart of the forest.
42. Once the two of them were alone, Miss Sayeki offered Nakata a chair. He thought about it for a moment before sitting down. They sat there for a time without speaking, eyeing each other across the desk. Nakata placed his hat on his lap and gave his short hair a good rub. Miss Sayeki rested both hands on the desk, watching him go through his routine.
"Unless I'm mistaken, I think I've been waiting for you to come," she said. "I believe that's true," Nakata replied, "but it took some time for Nakata to get here. I hope I didn't make you wait too long. I did my best to get here as quickly as I could." Miss Sayeki shook her head. "No, it's perfectly all right. If you'd come any earlier, or any later, I would have been even more at a loss, I suppose. For me, right now is the perfect time. Mr. Hoshino was very kind to me and helped me a lot. If I'd had to do it alone, it would have taken even longer. Nakata can't read, after all. Mr. Hoshino is your friend, isn't he?" "Yes," Nakata replied and nodded. "I think he is. But to tell the truth, I'm not all too sure about that. Apart from cats, I've never had what you would call a friend in all my life."
"I haven't had any friends either for quite some time," Miss Sayeki said, "other than in memories."
"Miss Sayeki?"
"Yes," she replied.
"Actually, I don't have any memories either. I'm stupid, you see, so could you tell me what memories are like?"
Miss Sayeki stared at her hands on the desk, then looked up at Nakata again.
"Memories warm you up from the inside, but they also tear you apart."
Nakata shook his head.
"That's a tough one. Nakata still doesn't understand. The only thing I understand is the present."
"I'm the exact opposite," Miss Sayeki said.
A deep silence settled over the room. Nakata was the one who broke it, lightly clearing his throat.
Miss Saeki?
Yes.
You know about the entrance stone, don't you?
Yes, I do, she said.
She brushed the Mont Blanc pen on the desk with her fingers.
I happened to come across it a long time ago. Perhaps it would have been better if I'd never known about it, but I had no choice in the matter.
Nakata opened it again a few days ago, the afternoon when there was lightning, lots of lightning falling all over town. Mr. Hoshino helped me. I couldn't have done it myself. Do you know the day I'm talking about?
Miss Saeki nodded.
I remember. I opened it because I had to.
I know. You did that so things would be restored to the way they should be.
It was Nakata's turn to nod.
Exactly.
And you had the right to do it.
Nakata doesn't know about that. In any case, it wasn't something I chose. I have to tell you this. I murdered someone in Nakano. I didn't want to kill anybody, but Johnny Walker was in charge, and I took the place of the 15-year-old boy who should have been there, and I murdered someone. Nakata had to do it.
Miss Saeki closed her eyes, then opened them and looked him in the face.
Did all that happen because I opened the entrance stone a long time ago? Does that still have an effect, even now, distorting things?
Nakata shook his head.
Miss Saeki?
Yes, she said.
Nakata doesn't know about that. My role is to restore what's here now to the way it should be. That's why I left Nakano, went across a huge bridge and came to Shikoku. And as I'm sure you are aware, you can't stay here any more.
Miss Saeki smiled. I know, she said. It's what I've been hoping for, Mr. Nakata, for a long time. Something I longed for in the past, what I'm longing for right now. No matter how I tried, though, I couldn't grasp it. I simply had to sit and wait for that time. Now, in other words, to come. This wasn't always easy, but suffering is something I've had to accept.
Miss Saeki, Nakata said, I only have half a shadow, the same as you.
I know.
Nakata lost it during that war. I don't know why that had to happen, and why it had to be me. At any rate, a long time has passed since then, and it's nearly time for us to leave here.
I understand.
Nakata's lived a long time, but as I said, I don't have any memories, so this suffering you talked about, I don't really understand. But what I think is, no matter how much suffering you went through, you never wanted to let go of those memories.
That's true, Miss Saeki said. It hurt more and more to hold on to them. But I never wanted to let them go, as long as I was alive. It was the only reason I had to go on living, the only thing that proved I was alive.
Nakata nodded silently.
Living longer than I should have has only ruined many people and many things, she went on. Just recently I had a sexual relationship with that 15-year-old boy you mentioned. In that room, I became a 15-year-old girl again, and made love to him. I don't know if that was the right thing to do or not, but I couldn't help it. But those actions must surely have caused something else to be ruined. That's my only regret.
Nakata doesn't know about sexual desire. Just as I don't have memories, I don't have any desire. So I don't understand the difference between right or wrong sexual desire. But if something did happen, it happened. Whether it's right or wrong, I accept everything that happens, and that's how I became the person I am now.
Mr. Nakata?
Yes?
I have a favor to ask.
Miss Saeki picked up the bag at her feet,
took out a small key and unlocked a desk drawer, then pulled out some thick file folders and laid them on the desk. "Ever since I came back to this town," she said, "I've been writing this, a record of my life. I was born nearby and fell deeply in love with a boy who lived in this house. I couldn't have loved him more, and he was deeply in love with me. We lived in a perfect circle where everything inside was complete. Of course, that couldn't go on forever. We grew up, and times changed. Parts of the circle fell apart. The outside world came rushing into our private paradise, and things inside tried to get out. All quite natural, I suppose, yet at the time I couldn't accept it. And that's why I opened up the entrance stone, to prevent our perfect, private world from collapsing. I can't remember now how I managed to do it, but I decided I had to open the stone no matter what, so that I wouldn't lose him, so that things from outside wouldn't destroy our world. I didn't understand at the time what it would mean, and, of course, I received my punishment." She stopped speaking here, picked up the fountain pen and closed her eyes. "My life ended when I was 20. Since then it's been merely a series of endless reminiscences, a dark, winding corridor leading nowhere. Nevertheless, I had to live it, surviving each empty day, seeing each day off still empty. During those days I made a lot of mistakes. No, that's not correct. Sometimes I feel that all I did was make mistakes. It felt as though I was living at the bottom of a deep well, completely shut up inside myself, cursing my fate, hating everything outside. Occasionally I ventured outside myself, putting on a good show of being alive, accepting whatever came along, numbly slipping through life. I slept around a lot, at one point even living in a sort of marriage, but it was all pointless. Everything passed away in an instant, with nothing left behind except the scars of things I injured and despised."
She laid her hands on top of the three files on her desk.
"All the details are in here. I wrote this to put it all in order, to make sure one more time about the life I lived. I have only myself to blame, but it's a gut-wrenching process. And I finally finished it. I've written everything I needed to write. I don't need this anymore, and I don't want anybody else to read it. If someone else happened to see it, it might cause harm all over again. So I want it burned, every last page, so that nothing's left. If you wouldn't mind, I'd like to ask you to take care of that. You're the only person I can depend on, Mr. Nakata. I'm sorry to bother you with this, but could you do it for me?"
"Nakata understands," he said, nodding seriously. "If that's what you'd like, Miss Sayeki, I'll be happy to burn it all for you. You can rest assured."
"Thank you," Miss Sayeki said.
"Writing things was important, wasn't it?" Nakata asked.
"Yes, it was. The process of writing was important, even though the finished product is meaningless.
I can't read or write, so I can't write things down. Nakata's just like a cat.
Mr. Nakata,
how can I help you?"
"I feel as though I've known you for ages," Miss Sayeki said.
"Weren't you in that painting? A figure in the sea in the background, white trouser legs rolled up, dipping your feet in the water?"
Nakata stood up and came over to stand in front of Miss Sayeki. He laid his hard, sunburned hands on top of hers on the files. And as if listening carefully to something, he felt the warmth there filter from her hand to his.
"Miss Sayeki?"
"Yes?"
"I think I understand a little now."
"About what?"
"What memories are. I can feel them through your hands."
She smiled. "I'm glad."
Nakata kept his hands on top of hers for a long while. Eventually, Miss Sayeki closed her eyes, giving herself over to memories. There was no more pain there,
for someone had siphoned it off forever. The circle was once again complete. She opens the door of a faraway room and finds two beautiful cords in the shape of lizards.